everybody, I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies that they love and the traces of the one reality that they see underlying them.
Yes, right. And this is episode number 37.
It is.
And it is.
It is being recorded in sunny Miami.
That's right. I'm in sunny Miami this week, here on business. And it has been raining all week.
Oh, so sorry.
That's all right.
So much for sunny Miami. Well, that's probably better than sunny Dallas. It was supposed to hit 100 yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And I walked outside and went, wait, I feel that sizzle. This is over 100. And it was like 104, 106. So.
Oh, wow.
Rain might be okay.
Yeah, yeah. Back home in Idaho/Utah now.
Yeah.
It's been about 95.
Oh.
So, yeah.
That's quite warm for you.
It is quite warm. But, you know, every summer we get that. So,
yeah.
You know, you get not only the freezing cold, but you get also the searing hot.
Oh, what a nice balance for you.
You bet. But I do love it. I do love the seasons. So today we're going to talk about a Pixar movie, my favorite Pixar movie, called The Incredibles.
Which is,
perhaps you've heard of it.
Yeah, one of my favorite movies. I've probably watched it 4 or 5 times.
Oh, yeah, me too. I've seen it several times.
Yes.
In fact, the whole Pixar story is something I've followed with interest my whole life, you know, ever since the Toy Story came out. And, you know, Joss Whedon continues to come up in almost every conversation.
God bless him.
But he has a tie to Pixar as well.
Really?
He wrote one of the script drafts of Toy Story.
Oh.
Yeah, one of the original ones.
Oh, you know what? I do remember hearing that.
Yeah, he was brought in to fix the script, kind of a guy. He, you know, they had their idea, they had the script written, and then Joss Whedon came in and rewrote it.
Huh. Did they keep what he wrote?
Oh yeah, plenty of it.
Okay.
He wasn't the last one to take a hit at it, but he is listed on the credits as a writer of it.
Well, I'm put in mind of what was it, X-Men 2, whatever that was, where he was brought in to write a script and they kept one line or one exchange of dialogue.
Yeah.
I won't quote it here. This is a Catholic podcast, but it was hilarious.
Oh, that's funny.
So.
Yeah, it's interesting reading about that stuff and how Hollywood does things, but Pixar's methods of doing things, you know, it's a company that I think everybody would just love to work for.
Mm-hmm.
But they do work hard.
Yes.
Brad Bird is the director of this one. And it's interesting. He came from animation. Before this movie, he did one called Iron Giant.
Oh, which we saw in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
We cried over no one
seeing
it.
Yeah, it was excellent.
Oh, brilliant.
And, and Brad Bird was not part of Pixar at the very beginning, but was brought in later. And The Incredibles was his first movie for that company.
Yeah, it was funny because Brad Bird has become one of those names like Joss Whedon, where I see Brad Bird's name attached and I say, we are going to watch this.
Yes.
And he, for our family, is kind of a continuing thread because he was very involved with The Simpsons back in the earlier days when it was good.
Yeah.
He was also a creative person or creative consultant for King of the Hill, which we enjoyed and which actually we're kind of rewatching now on Amazon Prime.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And
I haven't watched much of that.
Oh, it's, I think you would like it.
Mm-hmm. I'll give it a try.
Yeah, it's it always is advertised and sounds like it's kind of about a bunch of rednecks, but actually that's not really the case. On the one hand, they're poking fun at the Texas mentality, but on the other hand, what they're doing is showing people of basic common sense and then the insane world around them as filtered through this small town. And it's quite funny, and we really liked it. So we're watching it again. And then, of course, he did Iron Giant, and we hadn't really paid attention to his name before Iron Giant, but our kids were the right age. We were always up for any animation. And that movie was amazing, and I still remember the stories about people sleeping at the place to get it done, and then it wasn't marketed right, and it was a heartbreak story. But yeah. I imagine that's what brought him to Pixar's attention, because then we started seeing his name there eventually, I guess. So.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's broken out of, well, I say broken out.
Right.
It's interesting. Two of the Pixar directors went ahead and did live-action movies.
Yes, they did.
And Brad Bird did Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which was really good.
Yeah, that was good.
I enjoyed it.
I liked it. I didn't see it in the theater, and I think that might have taken away from its effectiveness for me. We saw it at home, and so I was like, oh, yeah, that was pretty good. But it still, you know, wasn't what it could have been, but... And it was much more highly praised. And then Andrew Stanton did, who did WALL-E and the Toy Stories and some other stuff, a lot of Pixar.
Yeah.
He did John Carter,
right,
which I feel he has been unfairly vilified, if I may just take this sudden stand here, because we rented John Carter, and I was going to rent, I was going to rent Cowboys versus Aliens or Unstoppable. And I was suddenly went, oh, wait, I see. I'm going for the bad action movie or the ones that haven't been very well critiqued. And so I said, let me go for the granddaddy of them. I'll take John Carter. And so we were expecting to be able to throw popcorn at the screen and laugh at it. And about two-thirds of the way through, Tom looked at me and said, what movie did everyone else see? Because we're enjoying the heck out of this.
Oh, that's
so
great.
That either tells
I have
you
not
something.
Yet seen that movie, but it's on my list.
Well, it either tells you something about our movie appraisal versus yours, or that they were all wrong, and I'm going with that they were all wrong.
Excellent. So, that is great news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rent it.
I'm going to. Things have been crazy for me for a few months.
Yes.
I'm on the tail end of it, so.
Yeah, well.
When you're I told my daughter, we're going to be watching some movies when I get home, hon.
Yeah.
And, well, one of them is Abraham Lincoln, and the other one, I don't know if I can take my daughter to that. Can I take my daughter to that?
Yeah, it's R-rated for a lot of gore. There's a lot of kind of graphic vampire killing, but I didn't watch most of it. There's not really any sex. There's somebody who walks around dressed like a dominatrix. She's a bad vampire, and I don't understand why. She's the only one who's not dressed in period clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And she can do things like walk up to a pastor of a church who doesn't say, you strumpet, get out of here. He just says, ma'am, would you like to attend a service?
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, she doesn't mind a lot of blood and gore. And don't see the 3D, by the way. It was horribly distracting, I found.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I had no choice. I was at a screen.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And another one that I want to see that she has already seen, my daughter is 11, almost 12, by the way, is Brave, the latest Pixar release.
Me too.
Yeah. So I said, well, we're going to have to go again when I get home.
Yeah.
And she said, okay. She's actually excited about it. So.
Yeah,
so it must be good if she's willing to go see it again.
We're waiting for it to clear out so it isn't the first or second weekend. But, yeah, what I've heard is that people have said it's too much Disney and not enough Pixar, but other people have said, no, it's an original fairy tale that's actually quite good.
That's good.
So
it appears to be kind of Disney territory, doesn't it? It's got your princess and... she's got some problems with her parents.
Well, but as somebody pointed out, these days, all anybody seems to be able to do is take Snow White or one of the old standard ones and tweak it and update it and make it, you know, modern, which is fine. I don't mind that, but don't look down your nose at something original.
Yeah, yeah. So I am looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the whole story about how Pixar and the whole Pixar-Disney relationship has been really interesting to watch, too.
Mm-hmm. Tom gives me a prize. My husband, he's like
it's
you.
A whole different thing. Yeah. Well, I mean, I love Disney. I love Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
And I love reading about those two companies. And then, you know, Pixar has the added interest in the technology that they developed, you know, as a techie type myself to read about what they did, you know, from there was no computer animation to look at what they're doing now is an amazing thing to read about.
Plus we can link this back to watching Wrath of Khan. That's their first paying job in a movie. And it was the first time computer generated graphics had appeared on film like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Genesis Planet video.
Yeah. Well,
there's a book called The Pixar Touch by who's the guy who wrote that?
Tom Redmond.
David Price. David A. Price. And in that, they were, you know, these guys are trying to do computer animation, you know, from the University of Utah and all this stuff. And time goes on, and now they've got a company, and they're trying to do it. And they get approached by, you know, the Star Trek folks, and they said, we need something here. And these guys said, oh, we can do that. We can definitely do that. And then they say, well, how are we going to do that?
Yeah.
And they were constantly doing that kind of stuff. And then they said, we don't have enough resolution for you for a big screen yet. And they said, no problem. We'll put it on a computer monitor. And it'll, you know, that's the resolution you'll need is what they, you know, the characters are going to be looking at a computer monitor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that's the resolution that we need. And they said, we can do that. So were very excited, and they knew that they had their breakthrough opportunity, and they hit a home run with it. Because, everybody was like, wow, you guys can do that? You know, start doing this. And then they did things like in Young Sherlock Holmes. I don't know if you remember that movie.
Oh, yes,
there was,
I do. Oh,
there was a villain in that.
The guy coming out of the stained glass?
Exactly. The stained glass was Pixar.
Okay. Which, yeah. I haven't seen that movie since it was at the theater, which is a long time ago. And
But it's
still
cool that you remembered.
Yeah,
I know. Exactly what it was. So.
Not much to remember, but I remember that. It was very good.
Yeah. So that's fascinating. But what makes it even better is that darn near every single movie that they've made is excellent. It's not only excellent to look at, but the story is excellent.
And that was going to be my point. They understand and love story, and they're willing, usually, to go back and begin again from the beginning if the story's not good enough.
Right.
You know, which I think is what happened on Toy Story, where it was actually who was running Disney at the time, the guy everybody likes to vilify. Eisner?
Eisner, that's him, yeah.
Took them, he saw the first run through, and he took them and said, no, you don't understand, because they had made Buzz Lightyear the bad guy. And he said, no, you don't understand. This is a buddy movie. And they went, what? Mm-hmm. And he took them out to some cabin in the woods and made them watch buddy movies for a weekend. And they came out and went, OMG, we are changing it around.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, they kept saying,
strength.
In that book, The Pixar Touch, they kept saying that Woody was a little bit too mean.
Or maybe, Woody was the bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't really a villain, I guess, but he was just
sniping.
Not likable enough.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when he would throw Buzz off the table or whatever, trying to get Andy to notice him, he just wasn't, you know, people were like, you know, well, what a jerk.
Yeah.
they weren't thinking, you know, and then they turned it into, he was jealous and everything, but it ended up being an accident.
Far.
You know, for Buzz to get tossed out the window was an accident.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though he was trying to do something.
Yeah, even though he was just acting out of frustration and anger, as people do, then it went way too far.
Exactly.
Right. Well, and The Incredibles shows just the progression of how people are able to tell a really great story. That I think the strength of their stories is that at base, these people are smart, and they're also people like us. Not the toys, really. Well, the toys are, but it's because the writers are. And so you'll see different themes reflected in the stories. Like, you know, there's the theme of buddies and family and friends that go throughout all the Toy Story movies. In Wall-E, it's love and being left behind and what happens after you've messed up, you know, the planet Earth, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In how do you find yourself again when you've lost yourself? In The Incredibles, what I saw, and I guess we, for anybody who hasn't been on this planet or seen it, we'll have to tell what it's about. But for me, I watched this movie and I said, I now know Brad Bird has children.
Mm-hmm.
He reflected so many of the frustrations of regular parents dealing with the concepts that the system puts on you, I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And because it's about family, it's about all kinds of things. It's
That's
about,
exactly what it is. It's,
you know,
yeah,
it's
to me,
family
to me, it's about life. Family. Yeah.
And married life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And married life. It's funny, on the Pixar site, and I'll link to this, there's a little video that Brad Bird has. It's, you know, where he talks about being a director.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, being a director is like being buried with questions. He says, you walk into work and everybody's just peppering you with questions. And he said, and you can't say, get away from me, because they're just doing their jobs.
Yeah.
You know, so I've got to answer all these questions, you know. And he said, and having kids helped me deal with that. Just because you lean down and you look your kid in the eye and said, I will be with you in 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
And then he says, 10 minutes from now, I know that I am going to be able to deal with this question.
That's funny.
Yeah, and it was funny. But, yeah, no question. It's, you know, so many of the movies out there, and again, you know, we go back to Joss Whedon. I mentioned this when we were talking about Serenity way back in our first podcast, where there's so few movies that show families that are holding together, or marriages that are holding together.
Yeah.
And you know, so Joss Whedon showed that in Firefly, and Brad Bird shows that here. You know, I mean, how easy would it have been for, you know, I guess in a kids movie you wouldn't want to do this, but for, you know, Mr. Incredible to, you know, run off and have an affair with this lady who obviously likes him.
Right.
You know, how easy would it have been to go down that road? But, you know, that's just not the guy that he was. And it's refreshing to show that even though that they had trouble at the end, it's kind of exhilarating to see how they came together and, you know, pulled everything off.
I mean, I know, think of what an accomplishment that is. And I know that wasn't the goal, but that's what comes out of telling a truthful story based in reality and then just taking it and making it fun and adding all the layers on that they do. But this movie shows what happens after you've been married for a while. Your kids are at those ages. You're used to each other. It's kind of that familiar routine. And your life hasn't turned out the way you hoped it would. All those dreams and promises of, you know, my bright future and I'm going to do this. Well, guess what? You're working in an insurance company in a cubicle, whether the government did it to you or not, which is their case, or whether you have to hide your powers, which is the wife's case. She's having to deal with his need for excitement in the old days and hold the family together. He's loyal to her, but he's trying to find himself again. It's really an extraordinary look at family when you kind of take it apart that way without ever being plotting or hitting you over the head, because it's against the superhero dynamic, which just super quick, I guess we should just say that the premise is that there are actual real superheroes, and thanks to our litigious society, which is another commentary that's definitely made.
Yes.
Mr. Incredible is sued by someone for saving his life when he was trying to commit suicide, and then the damages for foiling a supervillain who is probably my favorite supervillain.
Bon Voyage.
He's a French mime. Yeah. And although he does speak. And he basically sets off this string of events that everybody's being sued and all the superheroes have to not be super anymore. They have to be like everyone else because it costs too much money. The government's constantly going broke, having to pay for all this. And so then where we see the story picked up is they're trying to live their normal lives. And then what it does to the kids, because the kids also have superpowers, at least two of them do.
Mm-hmm.
Violet, which I never connected with shrinking Violet until now, who's very shy, Dash, who's super fast runner. But so they are required to hold themselves down to the average level. Also, they're not allowed to be special.
Right.
Which is what brings up, to me, one of the key lines that's echoed later, you know, everyone's special, Dash. Which is another way of saying no one is, says Dash. He mutters it back at his mother.
Yeah.
So, and that's one of those things where the kids all get given an award because they showed up to school that day. Well, the kids know it's ridiculous. My kids would come home with these things and I'd go, oh, so it was the awards thing. Did you get anything? And they might show me one that was actually for something extraordinary. And I'd say, well, what are those? Oh, that's just because I came to school and they threw it away. You know, those adults are fooling no one's but themselves when they give those out.
Yeah, you're right.
So, and anyway, so then a supervillain comes up.
Yeah, right. It's a kid who is his biggest fan, Mr. Incredible's biggest fan.
Right.
And, And during this big bon voyage scene, Mr. Incredible has to leave this kid behind, you know, because he's busy fighting this
right.
supervillain, and he doesn't want the kid to get hurt. So he offends this kid. And then now you flash forward to later, where this kid has now grown up and he's spent his entire life since that day creating things to destroy Mr. Incredible.
Yeah, vowing revenge.
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially.
Right. And, you know, you can tell a great movie when you watch a movie again and you get something brand new out of it.
Right.
And one of the things I got out of watching it this time is kind of, you know, at this time in my life, you know, doing a job change and things, I can feel what Mr. Incredible is going through.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
So I've gone through from the cubicle in the insurance company to a different job. And not that this job is so much better than my other one was, but it's a change of scenery and it's exciting. And I can feel my whole life changing. You know, my outlook on everything and, you know, things are just brighter.
You're kind of coming alive.
I'm coming alive, exactly. And that's what Mr. Incredible did. You know, everything in his life got better once he, he gets this call. He ends up going to this island and fighting this robot as Mr. Incredible, which he's been suppressing, you know, forever.
Right.
For a good long time. And that wakes him up. And he's hiding it from his wife because his wife doesn't want...
they've been moved three times by the government.
Every time he reveals himself as Mr. Incredible, they have to move.
Right. It's like a government witness protection program. And they're not going to do it again. And well, and it kind of... It's interesting that you say that because it's... We watched The Wrath of Khan again last weekend because Hannah, our 23-year-old oldest daughter, is now watching all the original Star Trek on Hulu. And which, you know, made me love her even more. And she got past the episode with Khan's introduction, and then she wanted to watch The Wrath of Khan. And I said, great, because Tom had given me the director's cut DVD, and I hadn't watched it yet. So we watched it this weekend, and at one point, Mr. Spock says to Captain Kirk, you know, you should never have accepted that promotion. Your destiny, your first and best destiny, is being a captain of a starship, and to not follow that is a waste of good material. And I thought, we had watched The Incredibles just the night before, getting ready for this, and I thought, that's kind of the essence of that message, of for all those people not to be allowed to express their, I'll say, because we're on this podcast, God-given abilities, what is so clearly a part of them somehow is to take away from them. It's a waste of good material, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't mean you were wasting good material. It just means that maybe, you know, now's the time for you to express yourself here, and that's why you're coming alive, because you can use all those talents in new ways, and, you know, it's exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, it's like your family moving.
Yeah, yeah. You spend a lot of time wondering, you know, are you doing the right thing, especially when you have a family. You know, when you make moves like this, it's harder because you're like, am I doing the right thing? Am I putting us in a worse position? You know, it's how much risk can I take and all these things. You know, and then the whole question of God comes in. You know, and when you think about vocation and what vocation means to a lay person, and, you know, are you following what God would have you do?
Right.
You know, I mean, these thoughts always come to mind. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but, you know, if, you know, I feel that I'm walking that road, but
well,
I guess we'll see.
A lot of the times, the only way you know is if it feels right when you're doing it. I mean, you know, not good, but right. But also, if you look in hindsight, you know, you can see the path fairly clearly that you came down. And when you go, oh, this led me to this, which is where I'm very happy right now. And it's because I'm using all these skills in a way I hadn't thought, or in doing something new. And it's interesting watching you or hearing you talk about that, because we're also watching Rose out in California, who's still job hunting, poor thing, and just can't get that break. And she kind of runs into the dilemma that I never had, since I didn't have any faith when I was that age, which in the sense of job hunting was kind of good, because you just kind of did what you could, and it turns out that was fine, you know? You worked a job and changed jobs to do something better, hopefully. And she also balances that, because she would just take a job if somebody would offer her one. That would be fine. But she also balances that with this worry of, is this where I'm supposed to be?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm not supposed to be in California. Maybe that's not, you know, God's plan. And Tom and I are like, okay, you can't worry about that.
Yeah,
that will become apparent later. You have to do the best you can. If you can't find a job out there at the end of the appointed time that we're going to pay for, and you don't want to get a job and continue supporting yourself out there where you look, then you come back here or wherever you want to go, and you start trying to find a job there, because that's a pretty clear sign. You can't worry about, maybe I should move. Maybe you just do the best you can and go on.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. I've heard vocations talked about before from a context of the removal of obstacles.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, that as obstacles are removed from your way, it's a helpful sign that you're headed the right direction.
Yeah, I've wondered about that myself for her, and I think that's why, because she's been out there since January. So, you know, it's legitimate in June to start thinking about it. And the thing I find interesting, as I just kind of observe this, because it's really not my thing, it's her job to find a job, is she said that she's started going to daily mass every so often. And she's always been real good about going to mass. I've never pushed her or anything, because that's, if it doesn't come internally, other than a gentle reminder if it's never happening, that's also not my job.
Yeah.
In a sense, once they're that old. And she said, you know, a few days a week, she said, it's just nice. It's quiet. You can think better. And I was like, yeah, that's what being in front of the tabernacle does for you, because you're at Jesus's feet at that point. Things should be a little clearer. You should be able to think a little better somehow. Whether you get an answer or not is different. But it made me think of a time when it was Lent during one of those big long things, and I was praying, and I had a lot of time to pray because maybe it was Good Friday or something, or anyway. And I was thinking, I suddenly was like, oh, well, while I'm here, I'll start praying for all the people I know. So I'm praying, and I'm like, oh, and for Rose, because at this time she was in high school. I was like, I don't know what her vocation will be or what she'll do, and she's wondering that herself. So, you know, any answers? And as that happens, I look up, and we happen to be in the very first pew, and all these people come and kneel in front of us, and in front of me is a line of five of Mother Teresa's sisters kneeling.
Wow.
Daughters of Charity, who they have a place in Oak Cliff, which is a poorer section. And so I was like, I've never seen them in our church before or since. And I was like, okay, I don't know if that's an answer to anything, but it certainly stuck with me this whole time. And so when she said she's going to daily mass, I was like, I don't know if any of that ties in, but it makes me remember it. I don't mention it to her because that's, again, not my thing, I think, but at this point. But those are all the things that if you have faith, you do the best you can, but you also just kind of wonder. And I think if you're open, it's got to be helpful some.
Yeah, no question. Definitely it's helpful.
Is
and
it?
I
haven't had to look for a job under those circumstances, so.
Yeah. I still wonder, though. You know, I'm just...
Yeah.
Things are, you know, they're uncertain.
Well,
Of
course, your job fell in your lap, so...
Yeah.
Talk about removal of obstacles, and it was something you would never think of otherwise, so...
Right, right. So maybe same will happen for her.
Yeah, well, that's what we hope. She has to get herself in the right place somehow, but I'm sure she's learning something, and it's a good experience, and blah, blah, blah. All that stuff.
She's going to be great.
At something.
Hang in there, Rose.
Because she's already great. Well, she started writing a book now.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so I'll get to read it, if nothing else.
I have a feeling other people will, too.
Yeah, let's hope.
Yeah.
Well, and so that kind of brings us back to the Incredibles in terms of all these people through although it's extreme and exaggerated and funny and clever and wonderful, but through the stress and danger of what they experience, they find their true selves.
They find their true selves, right. All of them do.
Yeah.
All four of the family.
Right.
Because, you know, they're strained. You know, not only are they strained by the fact that they have to pretend that they're not what they are.
Mm-hmm.
But also there's the distrust that's created by the husband, you know, Mr. Incredible, going off and doing this stuff on his own. It's making him feel really good.
Yeah.
But he's sowing distrust in his wife, and eventually she overhears a phone call that she misinterprets. And she thinks he's having an affair, and what he's really doing is going and fighting bad guys.
Right.
But she can't help but come to that conclusion. So she finds out where he is through this Edna mode.
And I think Brad Bird voice that?
He did. He voiced her. They said that they brought in several people to try and voice that, and he said, no, like this. And they said, well, why don't you just do it?
That's good. Cape it, boys.
Yeah, she's one of the funniest characters in the show.
Oh, she's hilarious.
Yeah.
And so she also is not being able to live the potential that she enjoys because she designed all the superhero costumes, and she was very famous for it. But since then, she's gone on, and she has shows in Milan, and she's a very famous designer. But she jumps at the chance to really fulfill the challenges that designing superhero suits brings.
Right,
because I noticed that, and as you say, how can we notice so many things in this movie? Because it's so good and multifaceted.
Yeah, for
but,
sure.
Yeah, she's like, oh, now I can do this. I've really, you know, I've so missed it.
Oh,
she's
yes.
Just relishing, you know, this one's designed for friction. This one's designed for being invisible. This one for the baby. I don't know what his skill is. So it can take anything, fire, bullets, you know.
Yeah, and they're shooting missiles at this baby outfit.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I just laughed. Yeah. So, So, from there, then Mrs. Incredible, who is Elastigirl, ends up, you know, flying this jet. You know, that's another skill she has. She can fly planes. And she ends up flying this jet to this island where Mr. Incredible is, who happens to be in grave danger.
Yeah.
And needs some help.
Thank goodness.
But her two kids stow away on there, too. And that's, you know, so Violet, who is voiced by Sarah Vowell, another person who I like quite a bit.
Oh, okay.
My wife told me one time that I'd leave her for Sarah Vowell.
I don't think I know her.
That's not true.
Sarah
Vowell is she's kind of my generation. She's a writer. She's kind of liberal. She did a lot of radio, public radio, This American Life.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a very distinctive voice, as you can hear from Violet. If you look at one of the extras on the Incredibles DVD, it's called The Vowelette.
Oh, okay.
And it's a little essay that she wrote.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so. Oh. But anyway, the character Violet, like you said, she's kind of withering and very timid, not confident at all.
Right.
And she's, you know, her powers are needed. And that's another thing that I thought was terrific about the script is all of their powers, they've all got different powers. They were all needed.
Mm-hmm.
To make one big whole, to make them survive this whole thing.
Right, because it also brings them together as a family. They can fully appreciate each other as people and as part of the family unit, because before, the father wasn't paying any attention to the kids, the mother's struggling to keep everything together, but she's the only parent who's actually present right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kids are not able to respect themselves. Or in Dash's case, he's being defiant and using his powers whenever he can, getting into mischief because he's so unhappy that way. And so, but they can all appreciate each other fully for who they really are.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a healthy, functioning family.
Yeah, and they function as a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's just cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's exhilarating.
Yeah, and it's epitomized by that moment when they're all standing there having fought off the bad guys. You know, and they all stand there with their powers ready, you know, ready to attack. Right before Syndrome walks in and freezes them. But other than that.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And they're all needed in the finale when they're fighting the giant robot that's in, I guess it's New York City.
Yeah.
Whatever big city. And even though they keep telling the kids, stay out of the way, stay out of the way. The kids are the ones who understand working the remote better than anyone, of course. But they also, you know, are needed for their running and their being invisible and all this stuff in order to come together as a crime-fighting unit, essentially, with Frozone, who's another great character.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, as the
Frozone.
Buddy. That's, you know, Tom quotes that scene to me all the time. I am your greatest good. When it's, where's my super suit?
Yeah.
Why do you need your super suit, his wife says.
Yeah.
For the common good. Oh, no, I've had this dinner planned for a long time. And it's, again, that little snippet of married life that everyone who's ever been in a long-term relationship can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh, not work now. You promised.
That's right.
It's for the greater good. I am your greater good.
I love it. Yep. That's fantastic. Fantastic stuff.
Well, also, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, we can't forget the look of the whole film, too. I don't know what you'd call, it's almost like a 1960s.
60s spy retro. Come
yeah, exactly. And
James Bond.
It's
and the
it's
music.
Awesome. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, and the music. I mean, everything fits together.
Michael Giacchino, if you listen to that score, it musically is what the set is visually. It just is evocative of every spy movie you've ever seen that was done in the 60s in high fashion at the time.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's so perfect. They hit all the notes there. Even the house they live in is very, you know, 60s retro.
Yeah, all of the furniture and all the stuff, the vacuum cleaner she uses.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just the attention to detail, you know,
it just
bears repeated watching and the artwork and man, it would just be something else to work for that company.
Oh my gosh! Yes,
but Brad Bird, you know, he's definitely a demanding person.
I can imagine, because you don't get that level of detail without being demanding.
Right. And he said, you know, in that same video, which I'll link to, he said that, you know, one of the hardest things is when an animator does something that's really, really great that he can't use.
Because
this stuff, you know, it takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could have an animator work a week or two on something, and then they watch it in their dailies, and everybody laughs, and he says, you know what, that is really, really funny, but it doesn't fit what we're doing here.
Yeah.
And he has to make that call. He has to make that call, and he says that is brutally difficult.
But so necessary and such a good talent, because we just watched Hugo. We're going through a spate of watch a lot of movies. So I'm not having to work in the evening. So, and so we watched Hugo, and it was, you know, magical looking, and all the acting was great and all this stuff, but it wasn't focused enough.
Yeah.
In fact, I went and got the book because I thought, you know, does the book also try to tell two complete stories so much? Sometimes books can do that much better than a movie, but it's like halfway through the movie, you're yanked off track into something else, and then they suddenly try to cobble it all together again, and I'm like, wow, it could have been much better, but something was wrong, you know? And these movies don't seem to have that problem. The Pixar movies, somehow, the team, whether it's the team or the
and it must be, it's got to be the team. You know, and I say that only because they keep hitting home runs.
Right.
And it just got to be that their process. Our friend Tam, you know, from the SFF Audio Podcast, he sent us a list, and I'll link to this too, a 22, what do you call it, 22 keys to storytelling or something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 22 rules of storytelling, according to Pixar.
Okay.
And it was on the IO9 website.
I'm
just calling it up here. And like number one, you admire a character for trying more than their successes.
Oh, yeah.
So you got to keep in mind what's interesting to you as an audience, not what's fun to do as a writer. Very different.
Yeah.
Trying for theme is important, but you won't see what the story is actually about till you're at the end.
Right.
Now rewrite it.
Oh. Yeah. I'm going to have to look at that list.
Yeah, and I'll send that over to you.
Well, yeah, because I remember hearing about Brave, or I was just reading it. I think I was reading Stephen Gray Dennis. I don't know how you say his name.
Uh-huh.
Review. I don't know if you read his reviews at
DCFilms.com. I don't read him, but I hear him sometimes on Catholic Answers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he comes on every now and then and does movie reviews.
I look at his reviews because I don't often read the entire review until I've seen the movie, because although he tries not to give spoilers, his reviews are so in-depth, inevitably they give me something I don't want. Mm-hmm. But he was so mad about spoilers being given for Brave that he was very careful not to put anything. And so that was, I read it all, and he was talking about the fact that he starts off saying this movie has a lot of expectations on it. It's Pixar's first female protagonist, which I had never occurred to me. Mm-hmm. It is one that they had a female director on and they pulled her partway through production. And he said a lot of people criticized that, of course. And that struck me. I thought they're not afraid to make those changes if they think
they're not. In fact, Ratatouille, Brad Bird took over Ratatouille.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, he came in early enough in the process. It was about 18 months before release. So he had a huge effect on the movie, but the director wasn't working out.
Yeah.
So they were not afraid. They were like, hey, we got 18 months. Brad, you take this over.
And I thank them, because that's one of my absolute favorites. As somebody who has always loved cooking and reading about food and all that kind of thing, I just watched that and went, that's right, that's right. Oh, yes, yes, they did this. You know, I was a total food nerd about the whole thing.
There's an extra on the Ratatouille DVD that I just loved. It had Thomas Keller in it. It was Keller and Brad Bird, almost compared together. Yeah, from the French Laundry.
Yeah.
And they were kind of compared. Their methods of working were kind of compared in about an 8-minute extra.
Obviously.
And I loved it.
Extras. I'd never think about it.
Yeah.
Just a couple movies I watched it. In Bruges, because I went, what the heck did I just see? And School of Rock.
I watched Pixar extras. Definitely, you know.
Yeah, we should go through.
And the shorts.
Oh, the shorts.
Jack Attack. Surely you've seen Jack.
Yes,
Jack
of
Attack.
Course. The shorts we love. Those are amazing.
Yeah.
Probably that's one of the things that got cut out of the movie.
It's probably a path they went down and said, you know, that's not going to work, but let's make a short out of it.
That very,
you know, because you can imagine how the flow would have changed. It's interesting as you follow these decisions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If they had put that in the middle of the movie, it wouldn't have been the same movie.
Yeah.
They would have lost the emotional flow of it. Yeah. You know, and I can understand that, seeing that, and it's kind of neat.
Okay, there were two other things I wanted to say, though, that were almost toss-off lines, but they were given just enough importance that I felt, especially to Catholics, to anyone, honestly, but especially to Catholics, these would resonate. And one is when Edna is showing, why can't I remember her name, Elastigirl, the suits and everything.
Yeah.
And I believe she's like, well, that was in the past and blah, blah, blah. And what? Or maybe it was the old uniform. Anyway, she says, I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now. And there's something there that it's a Catholic. You see it stressed by Catholics a lot. It's more than a Catholic concept, but it is living in the present moment. We tend to spend a lot of our time looking back and, oh, the good old days, or if only I had done this. And we spend a lot of time looking forward. I can't wait till this happens. Oh, my gosh. And you spend all your time planning and working towards something in the future. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with those qualities, but it's very easy to let those take over right now.
Yeah.
Right now, what am I doing? Like when the wife says, it's kind of reinforced when the wife says to Mr. Incredible, you're not even paying attention. Right here is when our family's happening. You're missing the now.
Yeah.
You know, and
and that's a neat observation, because, you know I get guilty of thinking, okay, when this is over with, next July, things are going to get way better for me.
Right.
you know, and you once you get locked into that way of thinking, you're wasting a lot of time. I mean, because you're missing it now. You're trying to live in next July.
Yeah,
and your mind keeps thinking about next July, and you're giving up right now. And I've done that.
And we've all done that. I mean, that's a human thing. I mean, we can't. And in fact, I think if we blame ourselves for it too much, we're at fault there too. I mean, you have to kind of just go, oh my gosh, I'm doing it again. My thing used to be a lot. I would live in my imagination in terms of what if this horrible thing happens, or what if that could happen? That's so wonderful. And I would let myself dwell on those things more than even planning for the future, which was a real future, or now. And it's just one of those kind of daydreaming things where you kind of get you out of an unpleasant present for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember reading somebody, Mother Teresa, someone, I don't know, who just said, you know, you can't let your imagination be the place you live. You're not doing service to your own life right here, right now. And that's kind of what made me aware of that whole concept. And I think actually someone else said it, but Mother Teresa did say something about, you know, the past is gone. The future has yet to come. All we have is now. Let us live it. And that's how we all need to live. You have to be mindful of, I'm sorry about these things. I'll try not to do them again. Or I'm glad I had that experience. I'll take it with me. You know, I'm working towards this. That's a great thing to work for. Or I'm trying to avoid that happening. That's fine, too. But right here is when it happens. This is where, you know, dogs only have right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be a little bit more like that.
Yeah.
So yeah. I really enjoyed that message. And of course, for family life, that makes a lot of sense. Because you look back when your kids are older like mine and you go, why didn't I live more in the now? Well, because that's human nature.
Yeah, but, forgiveness comes into the whole thing too.
Right.
Because if you're holding on to something that happened in the past because you can't forgive somebody, you are doing yourself a disservice as well as that other person.
That's a good point. And yourself.
And yourself, yep.
You have to forgive.
You have to let it go so you can
sometimes.
Move on. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. Well, Brother Lawrence, I won't go into Brother Lawrence, but Brother Lawrence said, he used to say to God, something would happen and he would fail. And he would say to God, well, if I'd have had more of your grace, it wouldn't have happened. And then he would kind of forgive himself and go on. And the easy way to look at that is, oh, you're blaming it all on God. But if you understand enough about the concept of God's grace, you have to be open to, with prayer and everything, to listening to God. You have to keep yourself on track as well as expecting God to help you stay on track. There's a dynamic there that one simple sentence takes up that if you start reflecting on it, you realize he's really not putting it on God. He's putting it on himself. If I had more of your grace, how do you get that? How do you open yourself up to it? Okay, well, I forgive myself. I'll go on and try again.
Mm.
And that's kind of, I always kind of try to remember that.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then the other thing was they made a super point of after Mr. Incredible got a hold of Mirage, the female sidekick, you know, although she's much more realized than a simple sidekick, basically the Bond girl of the movie. If you're going that way, and he's threatening to kill her if Syndrome doesn't let him go and spare his family and all these various things. And he's like, yeah, go ahead. And you can see Syndrome is just curious to see what he'll do. How far will you go? Well, Mr. Incredible can't do it. He lets her go. And Syndrome's like, yeah, I knew you'd be weak. And later on, it's a rare moment. We see Mirage and Syndrome, and Mirage suddenly breaks in and says, you know what you did back there? It was not cool. And except she says, valuing life is not weakness, and disregarding it is not strength. And he says, oh, well, baby, I wouldn't have done it. And she's like, don't ever talk to me about that stuff again, because I know who you are now. And to see a statement like that in a movie directed to families, incredible. And that's sad that a statement like that has to be said. But the fact that they chose to say it and make that point, I think, speaks also to their integrity about life and what matters. to me, it was gigantic. You don't see that these days.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I hadn't thought of that, but yep, you're right.
I mean, in days when a family can sue for wrongful birth because their child was born with Down syndrome and win, because they would have had an abortion otherwise, in this country, I mean, I guess some people wouldn't think about it, but I'm thinking that poor child.
Yeah.
And those people, they don't know what they can. Now, easy for someone from the outside to say, but they have been fully formed by secular society that says your only worth is what you can bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
The what we can predict, we can see from you. And that's not true. I mean, you know, you read all the time in this particular instance that I'm bringing up, all kinds of people go, oh my gosh, I was so horribly depressed and upset. Our baby was born with Down syndrome. And now, 15 years later, or 10 years later, whatever, I can see that what they bring us is joy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see testimony after testimony from different people about this. But we see these examples all the time in our society.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, I'm stunned by what you said about someone suing. So that actually happened?
Oh, yes. It was Washington State or Seattle or, you know, I can't remember, but, you know, Pacific Northwest. And it's a couple whose amniocentesis had shown the baby was perfectly fine. And when the baby was born, it had Down syndrome. And they sued the doctor for wrongful birth because they would have had an abortion.
Wrongful
and the court,
birth. Holy crap.
The court ruled for them.
That's
right.
I don't know. Just when you think I've heard it all. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Well, wow. I think that's why that and a few other things, like in Holland, you have to carry a card on you, I believe, saying I want my family to make. I may be adding this part, but basically. It says that I do not want to donate my organs. They assume otherwise you do, and they won't necessarily ask your family.
Mm-hmm.
So do they have your best interest at heart? The Hippocratic Oath starts to get quite shady at that point. When is efficiency valued over life? And they're considering that in Britain now, here's the assumption. We just assume you're going to want to do this. You have to say you don't want to do it. I don't have anything against organ donation, but Holland is also the place where when I began blogging, so 8 or 9 years ago, I was stunned to read people writing posts about who were from there, writing things about how you could call in the doctor if you had a baby that, well, maybe a Down syndrome baby or something like that, and go, could you examine the baby? I think it's quite ill, quite ill. And the doctor, you know, oh, really? Uh-huh. And he would give it a shot and go, oh, look, it just died.
Oh,
and a little handshake, and he'd go away. And I know this sounds like I'm being paranoid and stuff, but I was stunned to read this.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you think about the HHS mandate, which I'm sorry to keep bringing up, but we are in the fortnight for freedom, that the bishops request we all pray and fast and work toward religious liberty. And so I've been thinking about all these life issues, because the idea that that contraception is something that we say is turning away from life, it's something that our society just doesn't get. Well, how far of a step is it from that, from suing for wrongful birth? I mean, I can't even believe it.
I can't believe it either. That's stunning.
And there was that Pure Journal in Britain where the two doctors wrote about, and to me, this, I have to give them credit, because this is a logical conclusion from the fact that if you agree with abortion, they said, well, you should be able to then say, they didn't use a term like wrongful birth, but basically if the baby's born and you don't want it, you should be able to kill it. And they were unable to understand the outcry that came out from the other medical professionals after this came out in this journal. They're like, well, we're just putting it out there. I don't understand. Why would you call it murder? You're doing it like you would allow it 3 days before the baby's born. So what they kind of did was rip the blinders off what abortion is, and no one liked to look at it.
Yeah.
But all those things kind of came together for me at the same time. And I sat around very depressed for several days because I felt like I've read a book about this already. It's called Brave New World. And mm-hmm. this is what we're living in. That book was kind of, you know, prescient.
Yeah.
So wow. that's why yep. that statement really resonates with me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. You know,
sorry,
I mean,
to bring it down.
No. I'm just thinking deep thoughts now. I'm just like, oh, no. But it is amazing that, you know, every time I think that we've seen how low it's going to go, it just goes farther.
That you can't be shocked. I know
yeah.
people looking at this little baby, their own baby, this innocent mm-hmm. little baby, sue for wrongful birth.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I mean, I honestly don't understand it. I mean, this is part of, well, and in the Catholic way of thinking, and many other faiths, that you are formed through your trials. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't want to look at the Catholic or Christian point of view, look at every myth we've ever been given that's a story that stirs you.
Mm-hmm.
Would Odysseus be who he is without all the things he's gone through? Or Penelope?
Yeah.
In that story, even the Indian folk tales and pick a continent, you know, North America or India. I mean, that's the archetype of the hero or heroine is what trials do you go through? What burns away is what you don't need. And the qualities you retain are what make you who you are. Well, this is how it's done in real life. It is taking care of the aged parent. It is going through, you know, the layoffs and the children who have problems, or the hopefully you never have anything worse than that happen. But how you get through all those things is what makes you into the person God means you to be if you do it with Him in cooperation with God helping you.
Mm.
You know, that's the basis of Christ's message of His life. He didn't get the easy way. He went through pretty much everything we all go through. And He looked like a failure. He was crucified.
Yeah.
And kind of thrown away by everybody. And His resurrection is the triumph for us that the Christian world, the way things really are, is upside down and backwards from what makes sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when we, and it's not that we go around looking for bad things, or even going, oh, I'm glad this happened to me. Now I can, no. But what you do is you hunker down and you get through it the best you can. And you get through it better always with God. You get through it better with your friends. But it forms you into someone different than you would have been if you'd always had it the easy way. And what we're looking for is the easy way now, too much. Without considering,
much too much.
Well,
right.
And I think the measure probably is that you're looking for it without considering, is it hurting other people?
Mm-hmm.
And what we like to define as hurting other people is getting broader and, or, you know, that it's not hurting them. That definition of not hurting them is getting so broad that we're really lying to ourselves as a society.
Yeah, no question.
Sorry to go off.
No, thank you for that. That was awesome.
Well, I hope so, because it just kind of came over me, so it all just spilled out. But
I loved it.
It's something I think I don't myself think about enough. I don't connect my life to either the apostles or Christ or even Mary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who Mary and Joseph, the Holy Family, the epitome of just, you know, like the Incredibles. They're the real-life Incredibles.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how do you live as a family?
Yeah.
Because for 30 years, you didn't hear much about Christ. He was just living his family life.
Yeah, I remember not too long ago talking to a class about that scene where Christ as a young person disappears.
In the temple. Yeah.
In the temple, and his parents are like, where is he? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can just imagine how horrified they were.
Oh, yeah. It's like you suddenly get out of town and go, what? So-and-so's
yeah.
in New York on his own.
Right.
And now we have to go try to find him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not at the hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, they were a family.
And think what they went through, because they didn't find him for 3 days.
3 days, yeah.
You often, I've thought about that before, you know, was there that blame that they had to try to hold back from each other? Did that bring them closer? They're the Holy Family, and Mary was theirs, and Joseph was specially chosen. So we assume they came through it well, but maybe that was part of their formation because they weren't immune to any of those things that we face.
Yeah. They were not, and that was part of the whole point of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole point of Christ becoming a man.
Right. That, yeah. And the Holy Family being who they are. I mean, it's funny. I remember the one actual true miracle I can say, because it was witnessed by Tom also, who is the least likely person to ever look for a miracle ever. I'm just going to say. I'm more likely. But was after I had prayed to the Holy Family, and it was when Tom's father had a terrible stroke, and none of us knew what to do, and we were, you know, lost and clinging to each other, and it was awful. And for some reason, I just started really turning to the Holy Family, and do you want me to tell you the miracle?
Sure.
Have I told you before? I can't remember.
Yeah, you have, but I don't know if you've said anything here before.
Okay, well, then I'll
say. So please do.
All right, well, we're in Dallas, and he's in Houston, and it's a five-hour drive, and right before we left, we were dropping the kids off at different people's houses to stay while we were gone, and nothing like this had happened to either of our families before, so we're completely freaked out. And one of the mothers gave me said, wait a minute. And she went and got a rose from her garden and stuck it in like a water bottle and said, take this and give it to your mother-in-law. So I held it on my lap the whole way there because otherwise it would have gotten shaken apart. But it was still a bud and it was still mostly closed. And when we went into the hospital, we just parked in the hospital parking lot. And I said, well, I'll leave this in the car because I don't know what's going on. And we went into the hospital. And what we didn't realize is that it was connected to a hotel where Tom's cousin is an executive for the hotel company. And so we wound up staying at the hotel, courtesy of his cousin. And we didn't leave those premises except to get suitcases that night for the entire, like, 3 to 4 days. Mm-hmm. It was summertime. Well, I guess it was September because it was right after September 11th that this happened. And it was really hot and all this kind of stuff. And finally, we're done. His father seems better. We're leaving. And anyway, we have to leave. And so I'm waiting for the car. Tom's coming around with it. And as he comes around, I see this little flash of pink. And I'm like, oh, man, that rose is dead. And so I walk up to the car and I'm just laughing. And I'm like, oh, I forgot about that rose. Here, give it to me and I'll throw it out. And he has gotten out of the car to open my door, which he never does. And he's got tears in his eyes. And he says, Julie, you're not going to believe what you see. I was like, what? He's like, look. And he points at the rose. It is in the same condition it was in before.
Huh.
It's not wilted. It's not even opened much more. The whole car, of course, is full of this fragrant perfume, and it's sitting there as if it had been in a florist's refrigerator instead of a parking garage.
Holy
in
cow.
A closed car that whole time.
Mm.
And I said to my sister when I was telling her, I said, well, maybe it just would have been that way. She goes, right, that's why florists keep their places so hot like that, where the sun can hit the car and everything.
Yeah,
keeps the flowers fresh. And I went, okay, thank you. And I sat with that flower on my lap on the way back to Houston, and it was the weirdest thing. Within half an hour, we had just hit the outskirts of Houston. That flower had gone through all the stages of blooming and decay and the head drooping and petals falling off to the exact point you would have expected when the car was pulled up.
Holy smokes, yeah. Wow.
I just kept looking at Tom and going, did we see this? And he's like, I don't understand it, but we did.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Now, did that mean anything? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just think it was a sign that someone was there and they were listening.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And they are.
Yeah, they are. We don't get those signs. I mean, I think those signs are given in moments of extreme need.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, it was completely a gift. We weren't asking for anything like that, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Marvelous.
Yeah, so All right, it's out there for all of you now. to accept or laugh at as you will, because that's the other thing. Miracles don't really, in the rare cases, miracles will convert us. But miracles really are just signs of who God is. Right? Isn't that it?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Signs of God. They show us something of God. They show us more of his character or his nature, right?
Right, something that's contrary to nature.
Right, because Christ did.
Of course, leave it to me to break it down to something scientific or something.
Well, but that's in. But that's it is, how we think.
Uh-huh.
That's that how is. We think.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. Yeah. Well, and the thing too is that when you look at all the miracles Christ did, you know, there was still Judas. Miracles don't necessarily convert you or tell you anything. It has to be internal.
Yeah.
But they can comfort you. They can be a reminder.
That's probably why we don't see miracles all the time. You know, people who argue against Christianity or belief are saying, well, why not show himself all the time? Why not do this or that or whatever? And, well, you're assuming that by doing that, everybody would just convert, and that's not what would happen.
Well, look how easily things are explained away. Look how much trouble is gone to explain things away.
Yeah.
Have you seen that Stephen Colbert clip, which, he's interviewing a guy who's written a book about how the universe was created from nothing. And he basically says that, I'll have to put a link to it, but he basically says that nothing is what's pushing apart the universe. The nothing is active, although it's nothing. There's three kinds of nothing. And okay, so watching Stephen Colbert's face while he's saying all this is kind of echoing everything that every normal person thinks when they hear about nothing, okay? Mm-hmm. And I won't say the end of the clip because it is, of course, Stephen Colbert, trademark classic. But the funny thing was, Rose sent it to me. And I said, I love how Stephen Colbert is so quick at, you know, rejoinders and seeing the things that, you know, are illogical about what somebody's saying. And she says, well, what I love is the guy who's insisting that nothing is kind of burping out the something, because he keeps taking it back to, and so, of course, there's no need for you to believe in your myth about God. And the fact that he repeated it so many times makes me think that I think you're talking about something besides nothing here. There's some other agenda you've got.
Oh, I need to look at that. I did see that on your blog, but I wasn't at a place where see it. So
I need to I'll put a link to it just because
okay.
It's one of the things where you just go, the miracle of the universe. Yes, let's take it down to nothing. Okay.
Excellent. Yeah. Looking forward to that. All right.
Okay.
Well, good. Okay. Well.
Wow.
Go see that movie.
You probably, if you haven't seen The Incredibles, you probably won't have those kind of deep thoughts. But we kind of.
But the fact that you can is what makes it a great movie.
That's the thing.
Along with the rest of it. I mean, it's just one of those, it's a gem.
So funny, so true.
It looks great, and I just love it.
That's what makes it not Madagascar 1, 2, or 3.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So what's next?
Oh, Fahrenheit 451.
That's right.
And I just want to say, Sarah Reinhardt, we appreciate your fandom. Sarah wrote after she heard the last podcast and said, seriously, because I was halfway through Valley of Bones, I'm really trying to get ahead of you guys on this, and now you changed the book, and I don't have it, and I have to get it, and I'm going to have to buy it. The library won't get it to me in time. I like to know somebody cares so much that they're actually trying. Sarah, you touched me. Thank you.
That is something
and
else.
We apologize. We won't switch horses like that.
Right.
Much.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, well, good. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, who recently passed on.
Yes.
And then the movie is The Quiet Man.
Right.
On July 26th.
Yep. John Wayne.
John Wayne, yep.
In a an against type role.
Mm-hmm.
Not
and a I, Yep. I'm looking forward to that.
Yep.
Have not seen it. And then I picked the book for the next one, and it's a big one, so we better announce it. So fill that time.
Sarah, get ready.
It's The Stand by Stephen King.
Oh, one of the best books ever.
Yep, which I'm eager to read again. Yep, if you find the older version, it'll be shorter.
That's the one I'll be reading, because I've read both, and I consider it to be the best.
Okay, well, that's good. And I've read both as well, but too long ago to make that judgment. I don't recall the old one well enough.
By saying both, I guess we should say that basically in maybe 2000 or something, an updated version came out that had all the things that the editors took out that Stephen King put back in.
Right.
It was some anniversary of it or something. So yep. They took that opportunity, and I read both. So whichever one you wind up with, it's a great book.
Yep.
Don't worry about it. But
excellent book.
Yeah.
And it's available on audio now. The unedited version is available on audio now from Audible.
Okay.
Big long book read by Grover Gardner.
Okay. I'm just going to say also, if you are like me and don't like you might want to be able to skim some more unpleasant things, which we know Stephen King can put into stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Audio is not the way to go.
Okay.
There's some unpleasant stuff. I'm just saying.
Yes, there is. Okay. Well, that will do it this week then. We'll see everybody in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.